I think it's always fair to, you know, ask someone what are other, or a physician, what are other treatments? And, you know, if they can't give you any, maybe it's, I think it's fair to maybe seek a second opinion. And, you know, it's just really people doing their due diligence and trying to do what's best for themselves.
Welcome to FemPower Health. This is Georgie. In this pivotal episode, we explore pelvic congestion syndrome, otherwise known as PCS. This is a condition characterized by chronic pelvic pain, no surprise, many conditions are, and it's arising from varicose veins in the pelvic region. And we're talking to Dr. Marie Tazzarotti, who is an expert in interventional radiology. Prompted by a personal journey and a passion for illuminating overlooked aspects of women's health, this discussion sheds light on PCS's symptoms, diagnosis, and innovative treatments. If you've been navigating unexplained pelvic pain, join us to uncover insights into PCS and the hope it offers for many women. Hi, Dr. Tazzarotti. Welcome to the FemPower Health podcast. It's so wonderful to have you here. And before I have you introduce yourself, I have to tell people how this episode came about. So I have the luxury of having inherited varicose veins from my dad. And I was actually visiting Colombia and was meeting with my doctor, and he asked what I did, and I told him I have a women's health podcast, and he's like, we got to talk about pelvic congestion syndrome. And he started talking about it, and I said, wait, hold on a minute, what? And so immediately I thought, wow, I've never heard of this. And because of all the things I know of pelvic pain, my fear is, like many conditions, women are going doctor to doctor, being misdiagnosed, misunderstood. And what was even more fascinating to me is there is actually a fairly straightforward way to treat this. So that is why we are discussing it. So before we get into all the details, why don't you give us an introduction and then we can dive in?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to talk about this topic, and I'm glad one of my colleagues was able to kind of bring it to your attention. So I am born and raised in Kaneohe, Hawaii. I wanted to become a doctor after some kind of early experiences in the healthcare system with my family. I went to medical school, and when you're in medical school, you kind of get exposed to all of these different specialties. And I am an interventional radiologist, kind of surprised that's what I chose. But the reason I chose it was, as I was going through the different specialties that you get exposed to in medical school, I realized I liked a lot of them. I liked pediatrics, I liked OBGYN, oncology, urology, and interventional radiology is really a way that I was able to kind of help many different patients, young, old men, women, different types of conditions. But there are other specialties that do that. I think really what kind of was the galvanizing event for me for choosing interventional radiology was actually on my OBGYN rotation. There was a woman who had just had a baby and she was bleeding. And I had this fabulous conversation with her. She was so excited about her brand new baby boy. But all of a sudden, you kind of look up and you see some numbers that are scary. You don't ever want to see blood pressures this low. And an interventional radiologist intervened upon her and saved her. And I was so relieved. And I just thought, that's what I want to do. I want to be able to kind of make an impact on people's lives and really be there for them, kind of regardless of the situation. Hopefully it's not always that type of situation, but an opportunity to help people, and especially that patient who I just had developed such a quick and strong connection with, really did it for me. So I pursued the field. I did training in Boston, and one of my mentors, really, I kind of told her this story, and she was also an expert in women's health, fibroids, adenomyosis, and pelvic congestion syndrome, which we'll talk about. And I really worked with her clinically and got into the research, and we wrote a lot of papers together. And after finishing training, I came to Columbia, and I've really gotten to work with my great colleagues as well and treat women who have kind of been down a very long road to eventually be diagnosed with pelvic congestion syndrome, and to be able to help women who have, you know, they tell me stories about very long workups has just been one of the more fulfilling things in my career so far. So I'm very happy to be here.
What does an interventional radiologist do?
Great question. So George, you know, a lot of people don't even know about interventional radiology. So that's one thing. People don't know about pelvic congestion syndrome, but they don't know about interventional radiology. So we are a field, and we do a bunch of different things, but our defining characteristic, I'd say, is we do minimally invasive procedures using imaging. What that means is we don't make really big incisions. And since we are trained in both radiology and the field of the subspecialty of interventional radiology, we are really good at looking at imaging, whether that's CT, ultrasound, MRI, to really know what we're doing when we do these procedures. And the benefit of minimally invasive procedures is that the recovery is quite low. There's no big, no big incision, as I mentioned, and patients can be impacted very quickly. So we do minimally invasive procedures. So we aren't necessarily cutting patients open and looking directly at, you know, say bowel or peritoneum. Minimally invasive surgeons, it is a nuance in that typically what that describes is someone who can go in things laparoscopically or with tiny, tiny incisions and be using cameras or that type of thing to do procedures by directly looking and visualizing, you know, peritoneal implants or that type of thing. We use imaging to go as our guiding tool, typically endovascularly.
So now let's get into pelvic congestion syndrome. So first, why don't we talk about what it is and why it's so often misdiagnosed?
Definitely. So fundamentally, pelvic congestion syndrome, or also known as pelvic venous disease, is abnormal veins in a woman's pelvis. You can almost think of it, Georgie, as varicose veins in a woman's pelvis. And what happens is, you know, blood is normally supposed to go in and come out, in through arteries, out through veins. It's a very simple way to put it. But for whatever reason, the veins in the pelvis can not be functioning normally and taking the blood away. That could be because, you know, they've been stretched out and the blood goes the wrong way, or which is called reflux, or there could be a compression somewhere that's causing kind of a backup of blood. And when that blood kind of pools in the pelvis, it can cause bloating, pain, just discomfort, that type of thing. So that's fundamentally what it is. It's abnormal dilated veins in the pelvis that cause discomfort, pain. Second part of your question is, why is it so hard to diagnose? Why is it frequently misdiagnosed? Well, the symptoms I kind of told you, I think, really overlap with many things that you talk about in this podcast. And they can be quite vague. It can be almost hard to describe for a lot of women. And additionally, the other conditions that also have similar symptoms are very common. So it's always entirely possible that a woman could have pelvic congestion syndrome and maybe some type of, and can also have concurrent endometriosis or some bowel issue or bladder issue or musculoskeletal issue. So I think there's a lot of overlap that makes it kind of hard. The last thing is, I think a lot of people just don't know about it or don't believe it's real, to be honest. And that's something I think we can talk about a little bit more. But those are just some of the sweeping reasons why it can be difficult to diagnose pelvic congestion syndrome.
Oh, my gosh. So, I mean, just listening to you, my head is just spinning because I just finished the 4 episode series on endometriosis and pelvic pain, more focused on the nuance of endometriosis. But, you know, I think back to even episodes I've done on ovarian cancer, like when you said bloating, you know, there's so many of these women's health. And by the way, I didn't mean for anyone to think just because you have bloating, you might have ovarian cancer. It's just the thing that came to me. But the point I'm trying to make is there's all these, you know, sometimes like varying degrees of seriousness and pain for these women's health conditions that impact so many. And the theme is, you know, it's so hard to get diagnosed. Now, you know, if we were to break this apart, I think about, I'm a woman, I go to a clinician and I have all of these different symptoms. You know, for ovarian cancer, most people are diagnosed late stage. For endometriosis, I mean, people are debating the treatment, the diagnostics. You know, laparoscopic surgery is really the only way to definitively diagnose it. And even if you get the surgery, people debate if it's done properly. And so I'm sitting here listening to you. So my head is like, as a woman, how do I navigate this?
It's important to ask the question, you know, could I also have this? You know, if you've had pregnancies, if you have a family history, I think one of the things we might talk about, what are risk factors for pelvic congestion syndrome? It's something, you know, maybe worth thinking about asking, you know, whoever you're seeing, if it's OB, you know, is this something that we could consider? And maybe seeing an interventional radiologist to kind of talk about and try and tease apart a little bit more what's going on and if there's something we can do to help, you know, part of that as well.
Right. So then let's talk about the family history and maybe some things that could potentially indicate this is something we should investigate further.
Overall, it's pretty multifactorial. It's a combination of your genetics, what you got from your parents, and then some kind of exposure environment, if that's pregnancy, estrogen, surgery, or just, you know, doing a lot of things that increase the pressure in your abdomen and can have put stress on your veins.
Interesting. Okay, so here's a question. So like I mentioned that mm-hmm. I have varicose veins. Is that a risk factor? Because, you know, I always think of those as in the legs, but we're now talking about the venous structure in our pelvis, which, like, I mean, I'm so blown away that this is a thing we need to be looking at.
If you have pelvic congestion syndrome, it can go all the way down to your legs, and you can still have varicose veins because all the veins are connected eventually. That if your pelvic congestion syndrome isn't addressed, that your varicose veins will have a hard time being addressed as well. So to answer your question, yes, there's an association for sure. I think, you know, some of us are predisposed to have veins that just are a little bit weaker and more prone to reflux. And I think that doesn't stop at the leg and in the abdomen, if that makes sense.
So have you been able to decipher any sort of nuance in the way women with pelvic congestion syndrome describe their pain?
One kind of a classic thing that really gets my my suspicion for pelvic congestion syndrome or pelvic venous disease up is a woman who, this is kind of like the textbook type of thing, has had a couple of pregnancies, maybe after, say, two pregnancies. After the first one, she kind of felt this like pelvic pain, and it got worse. And then she had her baby, and she's focused taking care of her baby, and she still had these symptoms. And then maybe got pregnant again, it got worse. But what kind of, it's like a dull aching pain in the kind of lower pelvis, that what I think kind of distinguishes it a little bit more from some of the other etiologies is it seems to be worse when you've been standing or doing exertion for a long time, and better when lying down. And that's really because it's similar to kind of like varicose veins. When you stand and the blood's going down gravity wise, it pulls and it's not coming back up the way it's supposed to be. So if you elevate your legs or we can't really compress our pelvises that well, but you know what I mean? Like lying down and you can have some symptomatic relief, that really piques my interest. And I think that is a little bit different than some of the other ways it manifests. That said, you don't have to have that exact story, which makes it a little bit confusing, but definitely with that kind of worse when standing for long periods of time or exertion and really feeling better after lying down. That's kind of the thing that really gets my ears up, I guess.
So when people come to you, I mean, I'm so curious of the different flavors of how people get to you. You know, are you finding that this is one of the, you know, conditions where it's a little bit more understood, or is it because of the symptoms being what they are, you're seeing patients like you're probably the 10th doctor? Like what's the journey that you're finding?
They kind of do their own research, and I applaud those patients, and they kind of, you know, find this through their own research. And then they come and see me, and we kind of talk about, you know, what they've, who they've seen so far. And it's not uncommon to the story. Like I've seen a couple of physicians, typically OBGYN, gastroenterology, plus minus neurology, and sometimes orthopedics, because there you can also get back pain from this. And, you know, I just want to make a little, I think it's important that, you know, one thing about our field, interventional radiology, is we pride ourselves on being very multidisciplinary in nature. I would like to work with other colleagues and make sure that, you know, we are providing the best care. So I think frequently, you know, just because you've seen other physicians, it can be tough, but I think together, at least in my practice, we're very keen on just providing the best care and really kind of figuring out what's going on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, what about, so again, you know, I just recently interviewed pelvic floor physical therapist, and I know finally we're talking about the pelvic floor. There's a lot of startups that are focused in this area. One of my multi-appearing guests is expanding around the States, which is wonderful to hear. Do you find that, like, I'm assuming they have a pretty good sense of pelvic congestion syndrome as well, and I'm sure there's some elements of collaboration with them. I'm curious of that dynamic.
Yeah, I think, you know, I will say our kind of contact point between them tends to be OBGYN, and I think there's a lot of overlap with women who have pelvic floor conditions who might also have this. And I think this might be a recurrent theme. Like it's so common, and there's so many other things that are common that overlap with it, that I think that they do have a good sense of it, because especially if it has that kind of characteristic I mentioned to you in terms of getting better with lying down or standing up, that is a little bit of a kind of special or kind of unique aspect, I think, of it. But I think that, you know, kind of attacking, for lack of a better word, or addressing pain from multiple modalities and multiple angles, I think, is really effective.
Right. So I'd love to jump to the treatment, because this is one of the few things where it's like fairly straightforward, if I understand it correctly. So I don't know if there's one treatment option or multiple. So can you talk us through that journey of, you suspect it? I assume it would be suspect it, and then you have to do certain things to verify, and then you do the treatment. So walk us through that journey.
Exactly. Sure. So, you know, when I get a referral for or a patient I see for the first time for consultation of pelvic congestion syndrome, really the main thing for me is really getting a detailed history. And that really goes, you know, I think that goes for everyone, but you really want to know what are your symptoms? How are they affecting your quality of life? What makes it better? What makes it worse? And who have you seen so far? Like, what has been ruled out? Because as I mentioned, there are things that we really want to make sure are addressed as well, if they're also happening or haven't been kind of addressed. So assuming that, and I'm suspicious, or we want to make sure that if there is pelvic congestion syndrome that we address it. Next kind of step for me is imaging. We're interventional radiology, we need our imaging. There's different practices and different ways people practice across the country, but I think a lot of people really like to go with an MRI. A lot of patients come in with an ultrasound. OBGYNs frequently get ultrasounds or perform them themselves. So I think an MRI gives us more information. And we do MRIs, or I typically like to do MRIs that really look at the veins. They can kind of show us areas of compression or areas of reflux or dilated, abnormally enlarged veins. So once we get the MRI, I like to review that with the patient to kind of show them, you know, what exactly is likely the veins, or why the veins are causing issues. And that really helps kind of go through the treatment plan. Ultrasound is a great modality. It really gives us really great information about the pelvic organs, like the uterus, the ovaries, and it's a relatively short. It's not as long as some of the MRIs we get.
Right.
The downfalls are they're not as good. It can be, but it's very dependent on who's performing the ultrasound, the technologist, or the protocols at any given institution for looking at the veins, which is really what's important for pelvic congestion syndrome. So that's kind of the difference where I think MRI really has an added benefit. At least, you know, that's my personal practice pattern, because you can really kind of see in very great detail veins that go all the way up to kind of the level of the kidney. You can't really see that on ultrasound very right. well all the time. Some people you can, some people you can't, but, you know, MRI really helps with that. And certain protocols as well, you can also see if there's kind of reflux or abnormal flow, similar to, you know, ultrasounds you might get for varicose veins. So, but also on an MRI. So that's why I think MRI is helpful. It just gives us that added information that really focuses on the veins. I will be honest, CT can also do that, but I think MRI it just is better, in my opinion, in terms of the detail. Yeah.
So then what about the treatment modalities? You mentioned that there's multiple. So tell us more about that.
I just want to, you know, be completely transparent here. There are medical therapies that can be effective for a small subset of patients, which are usually hormonal based. You know, there's some data out there that they help, but for a large subset of patients, they don't provide enough relief that patients are satisfied. So then there are interventions, and they can be with interventional radiology or surgery. You know, kind of the biggest thing that surgery can do is kind of do a hysterectomy and nephrectomy to kind of remove the uterus and the surrounding veins. Yeah, that's kind of not frequently done, because I'll talk about what we can offer as well, and that's quite effective. The other thing is, surgery can also ligate or take out veins that are causing problems or refluxing as well. So that's kind of the surgical options. And, you know, they require incisions and a little bit long and general anesthesia. So they're a little bit on the longer side in terms of recovery. What we can do in interventional radiology based on what, you know, looking at the MRI, your symptoms, is through using small catheters and wires, we enter the vein either in your neck or in your groin. And the incision at the end is like very small. Using live x-ray, we kind of go into the veins that we're concerned about, and we take some pictures, can get measurements. So if a vein is refluxing or blood is going the wrong way, what we can do is we can kind of take it out. We can embolize it or sclerose it. And that's quite effective. We typically do that in a vein called the gonadal vein. That's very commonly sending blood the wrong direction. For patients who have compressions, which are basically their vein is being squished by something, typically an artery that's going across, we take pictures and we can put a stent in there to really open that up to help the flow go the right way and not back up into the pelvis. So there are a couple of options, but they're all pretty much done the same way, which is through a small kind of pinhole in the vein in the neck or leg.
So a question for you about the hormone therapy, because I know that you were alluding to something earlier today, and I just recently did an interview with an OBGYN who specializes in menopause, and we talked a lot about the changes that happen to our body. And I teased her. I'm like, are you going to tell me that every single woman in this needs to take estrogen and everything will be gone? Because we would go through each of the symptoms. And it was like, it's because of the estrogen changes. So, you know, is it also the case that with pelvic congestion syndrome that because of our hormone levels changing as we age, that this is one of the things that could be impacted? Our venous structure or is there not enough data to talk about what happens?
I say it's a little bit hard. I think, you know, it's really the hormonal changes of pregnancy that seem to do have their most effect on, in addition to, you know, there's just so much more blood in pregnancy. That's a lot more stress on the veins. So it's really hard to kind of pinpoint how much one is contributing to the other. But the reality of veins is as you kind of stretch them out, they have valves in them that help prevent blood from going backwards. As you stretch them out and you stretch out that valve, veins are kind of unforgiving that they don't always kind of snap back, and you can keep stretching and stretching. They get kind of more or less get worse, and changes in hormones don't necessarily help them go back to normal, if that makes sense.
Okay. So you were mentioning the hysterectomy. So I'm actually doing an episode on hysterectomies so that people know how to advocate for themselves. And, you know, it was like the first example you gave of what may need to be done. So in what cases would it be that a woman should consider the hysterectomy? Because you spoke about these minimally invasive procedures that seem incredibly straightforward. So tell us more about what might lead to needing that.
I would just say kind of, and it might be a little bit biased in terms of the type of patient that I eventually see, they're pretty hesitant to get surgery. I think one of your prior speakers kind of talked about a particular type of patient who just doesn't really want to have a question of, are the veins ever going to come back? If we just take out the veins, is this going to be the kind of final or the most definitive solution? But that said, I talk to a lot of women who have been offered hysterectomies for various conditions, fibroids, that type of thing. And I just hear kind of this story, and this feeling over it that, you know, they find it upsetting to have to, even if they don't want to have children anymore. And I can definitely understand that. So if they often ask if there's a way to kind of, you know, maybe down the line, if things get bad or this doesn't improve, maybe, but I want to try something else before I get there. And they ask us, you know, ask the interventional reality, is there something you can do? So that's, I feel like that's where we kind of come in. But, you know, the recurrence rate after these interventions, you know, if they're successful, and they have a pretty high success rate, and when I mean our interventions, interventional radiology is upwards of 80%. But there is a 80% of patients really have marked symptomatic improvement. 5% of those patients will have some recurrence. And there's a way we can kind of address and maybe do another intervention, but maybe there's a certain type of patient who's just like, I don't want to keep going through this. Maybe if I just go through that. But I'll say it's pretty uncommon, at least in my experience. But I will admit I do have a little bit of a bias in terms of the patients I see in that feeling and sentiment that they express.
Are there cases where maybe the hysterectomy is the option because it isn't an interventional radiologist who recommended it and who got involved, and perhaps the hysterectomy was done without people knowing the option that there's probably something more minimal that could be done? I mean, is that real? Is that a possibility?
That's definitely a possibility.
Even putting pelvic congestion syndrome aside, would it be fair to say that an option for people who are struggling in their pelvic area. If hysterectomy is the option given, and it could be dependent on the condition, would it be wise, generally speaking, for women to seek the counsel of a minimally invasive surgeon / interventional radiologist just to get another perspective on what might be happening in that pelvic region?
I think it's always fair to, you know, ask someone what are other, or a physician, what are other treatments? And, you know, if they can't give you any, maybe it's, I think it's fair to maybe seek a second opinion. And, you know, I don't get offended if patients ask, you know, tell me they're going to seek a second opinion. I think it's just really people doing their due diligence and trying to do what's best for themselves. So I think depending on the situation, but if they're just going to hysterectomy, that's it. I think it's worth kind of seeing someone else to see what other options there are, because there are a lot of other options.
Obviously, if someone needs it or wants it, that's one thing. But if there's something like a pelvic congestion syndrome where there's a fairly straightforward procedure, so it almost seems like a question women should ask is, what are the alternatives? What are my options, right?
And I think the sad part of, I think you and I both are kind of alluding to the sadness of maybe someone making a decision without having all the options laid out to them. That's tough. That's tough to undergo something big like that, not having not known about other alternatives that they may, that may have been better for them or may have been more aligned with what their desires are. I think that's a tragedy in a way.
I mean, if I had my druthers, I would like completely redo how our healthcare organizations are structured and even the patient journey and how they're navigating to the different clinicians. I know some startups are trying to do that in certain respects, and I hope they succeed and then can continue to expand into other areas, because the systems thing really creates a challenge for the clinicians who are trying to help and the patients who are seeking that help. It's just, it makes it tough.
Yeah.
So for this, like, they get the procedure, let's assume this is the procedure that is done with the interventional radiologist. What happens after?
Sure. So, you know, the way that this procedure is done, it's done as an outpatient elective procedure. So you'll come in, and during the procedure, you'll get some sedation through your IV. You won't be, you know, there won't be a tube down your throat type of surgery. It'll be, you know, some medication to help take away any pain, to kind of take the edge off some anti-anxiety. It's sedation. You know, some patients watch the screen or take a nap, that type of thing. Afterwards, when we're done with the intervention, you kind of come into our recovery area. Our practice is you kind of stay flat just to reduce any bleeding from the puncture sites, which are very small again, for about 2 hours. We want to make sure that you're able to eat and drink, you know, normally after receiving some of these medications through your IV, and patients go home the same day. Kind of, you know, things I tell patients to look out for. You might have a little bit more pain than you're used to for the 2 weeks, or not, I'm sorry, 2 days to 1 week after. And, you know, that's kind of just, we put something in your vein that there's a little bit of an inflammatory response that's really effectively addressed with ibuprofen or NSAIDs. I tell patients to take it easy for a week. You know, some people really like to exercise. It can be hard when you have kids at home to try to have a little bit of extra help just to kind of take it easy for about a week. But people can generally, you know, get back to light activities the day after, type of thing like that.
If I remember correctly, when I first heard about this condition, if I'm not mistaken, there isn't an official diagnosis code for this, and it has to be coded in a different way because people don't necessarily believe it's a thing.
Yeah. So this is a little bit of a tough question. I think we're kind of on shifting ground a little bit. They're always updating codes for this, and it can sometimes be a little bit tricky with the insurance companies reimbursing kind of this. And it really alludes to kind of a lot of what you're saying in terms of there isn't necessarily a diagnosis code that gets approved all the time. And sometimes we have to use alternative codes, which are still 100%, you know, accurate. Correct. Of what's going on. It just leads, when that happens though, it leads to confusion amongst multiple people, which makes it tricky.
Yes.
One thing I find interesting about, and kind of unfortunate about pelvic congestion syndrome is, I'm a little bit of a history nerd, so there's actually kind of a history to this. What's been unfortunate about pelvic congestion syndrome or pelvic venous disease is it's had a lot of name changes, kind of some rebrands. And when you get to, I feel like you probably know this.
I did not know about the rebranding. Let's talk about
in general, when that happens, people kind of I feel like you kind of, I think there's an inherent bias to it loses a little bit of legitimacy, or it kind of, people kind of forget about it. Like, what is it called? Is it that or this? So, you know, it was originally, I kind of first described in way back in 1949, it was called congestion fibrosis back then. And as we've kind of evolved as a medical field to figure out more about what it is, it started to become called pelvic congestion syndrome. And then there were these other diseases that we kind of knew about, such as May Turner, which people are now like, well, that's actually pelvic congestion syndrome. And more recently, it's, so you can see the confusion here that you really, you know, I think,
I have a marketing person I could probably hire. I know. Now the question is, who owns it? Is it the interventional radiology division that owns the branding of what this condition is called?
So, exactly. And so I think it's one of the known issues with, and it's just an unfortunate function of its history. It's renaming things, kind of being added to it under its umbrella, which makes it, it leads to a bunch of problems like this in terms of coding, insurance is buying into it. Like, we just changed the name. Like, what are, you know, I think in every, as you know, every process and thing like that takes time to change and catch up. So that's, I say that's something that we as a field know about, and we're really working on standardizing the language, getting diagnostic criteria, getting the data. It's one of the big research kind of priorities in the Society of Interventional Radiology, because there's just so much confusion, which is confusing to clinicians, patients, payers, that type of thing, that there's a lot of room to improve here.
Oh my goodness. No, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And again, it's all context, like to the person who's struggling, it's like, hello, people, just code it and just pay for it and just diagnose me. And to the people who are doing a million other things, it's like, yeah, but on my plate, I have X, Y, Z, and A, B, C, D, E, F. And so I hear you, but so welcome to our healthcare system.
No, but I think definitely we're working on it, because I think we do want, you know, I think we want to kind of streamline diagnostics. We want to really, you know, figure out what's the best treatment, best agent to embolize to really help women. So I think we've come a long way. It's kind of resulted in a history that's made things a little complicated in our current situation, but there's still a lot of efforts underway to try and really improve this and help a lot of women. I mean, pelvic pain is a big problem, and a large subset of that, as you mentioned, is unknown.
I would say, like, what's been the cleanest scenario that a person's come to you?
It's hard. It really is hard, because I think we don't want to miss cancer. So I think we get a lot of diagnostic testing. We don't want to miss someone who has Crohn's or something that's really serious that we should really address as well. So I think there is going to be some diagnostic testing, but there are very astute OBGYNs, other clinicians who get some of that initial diagnostic imaging, and they kind of doesn't fit the bill for a lot of the things that they're concerned about, which is good that those have been ruled out. But maybe on imaging, they saw kind of a weird vessel or kind of the symptoms. Or they had another patient that was treated by an interventional radiologist who's very similar and gets referred. So I think I have encountered that, but it doesn't mean that they still didn't undergo a lot of other diagnostic testing. But we're able to really, just to talk about like a patient story, I took care of a woman who was about 45 years old. She had three kids. So after her second pregnancy, she started to have pain. She's like, oh, you know, I'm pregnant. This is kind of part of it. And then she gave birth and she still had these symptoms, which were new from her first pregnancy. But she was so busy taking care of her kids, and she kind of soldiered through it and thought, you know, this is just how things are. But it really affected her quality of life. And then she had a third kid, and then she continued to have these symptoms. They actually got a little bit worse. And her OBGYN had seen her, and, you know, she had been ruled out for malignancy and some of the bowel issues. But really, she had that kind of classic history of really having some fullness that was really worse. I think she worked in a daycare, actually. So a lot of walking around, standing up, running around, and then at the end of the day, it just felt much better. And we were able to get some imaging that really showed a large pelvic veins and a vein that we were able to embolize, and she felt fine. Really much a lot of improvement after 1 month, and then continued for 6 months. And what I just found inspiring about her story was she's like, well, I didn't think I'd ever get back to this, because she had kind of thought, I had kids, this is my life now. But you know, she got to us pretty quickly, and I think she was appropriately worked up. I think that's really important too. But that's one of those types of stories kind of keep me interested in the field and wanting to do better.
That is awesome. Any words of wisdom that you may have for your healthcare professional colleagues? And it sounds like OBGYNs are probably the key here. Anything that you would love to share with them as they're seeing these women with complex systems?
Having a relationship with an interventional radiologist at your institution or your local practice or in the area is always very helpful to keep pelvic congestion syndrome or pelvic venous disease on your differential. You know, as medical professionals, when a patient comes in, we have a list of things that we think are more likely. And sometimes just due to a lack of awareness, doesn't make the list. And then it kind of eventually comes up. But having that kind of early on, just given its frequency, is something that can help. And interventional radiology colleagues are always here to help. So feel free to reach out.
Oh my gosh. Well, I feel like we need to collaborate on a tip sheet for women on this one.
Definitely.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. But thank you so much. And is there anything else, by the way, that you want to share? Maybe I didn't ask you a specific question, but there's a point you wanted to raise. Is there anything that I missed?
You know, one thing I noticed in some of your, I listened to a couple of your podcasts, is I think you've asked some of your other guests, you know, how can you find someone if you're a patient and you think I have this and you just want to find an interventional radiologist? You know, we have a website, the Society of Interventional Radiology, and I shared the link. And you can actually look up interventional radiologists based on country, state, and conditions that they specialize in or have a special expertise. And pelvic congestion syndrome is one of those drop-down options.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your dedication to this.
Of course, and thank you for doing this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I really appreciate you making time, and I can't wait to share this with folks. And I'm curious if people will be as shocked as I am, because I was like, wait, what? Something like, usually it's, we don't know how to diagnose and we don't know how to treat. And now this is like, we actually have a diagnosis, a way to diagnose. We just have to get to the path to get there. And oh, we can treat. So this is like a dream, in some respects, a dream symptom. So,
well, I hope some people find it helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me, Georgie.
And that wraps up another empowering session here at the FemPower Health Podcast. Now, before you dash off, I've got a quick, exciting invitation for you. Please join our vibrant community by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, because it's really your frontline update on groundbreaking women's health research, the latest health-enhancing products, fun quizzes to boost your health IQ, and unique discoveries that you won't want to miss. All of this delivered straight to your inbox, cutting through the noise of social media algorithms. Love today's insights? Show your support by rating and reviewing our podcast. Your feedback is more than just a pat on our backs here at FemPower Health. It lights the way for others seeking guidance and community in their health journey, amplifying the voices that need to be heard. And for a deeper dive into today's topics, check out the show notes and explore our website at fempower-health.com. Our site is a treasure trove of knowledge, neatly categorized by topics of interest and life stages, ensuring you find exactly what you need to empower your health journey. And your voice matters to us deeply. Whether you have a question, a story to share, or feedback on our episodes, reach out directly at info@fempower-health.com, drop us a message on social media, or hit reply on any newsletter. Your insights inspire our conversations. And a quick note, the knowledge we share is here to embolden you in discussions with your healthcare provider. It's not medical advice. Always consult with your doctor for health decisions. And remember, the diverse perspectives of our guests reflect their individual journeys, and it's not an endorsement by FemPower Health. Here's to empowering your health journey one episode at a time, and I'll see you on the next FemPower Health podcast episode.